It's Tuesday, April 19th. This is Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's one and only Pacifica Radio affiliate. I'm Zach, and with me is Mike. We are the voices delivering you local, national, and international news and views. If you're listening, we thank you for joining us, and we know why you've tuned in. You're sick of business as usual, you're sick of lies, and ready for the truth. Well, this is what Mike and I aim to do. These are your truth headlines for the week of April 12th through the 19th.
Good day, Peoria. We will bring you thoughts on Bradley Manning. We'll tell you even more reasons why to dislike the Peoria Tea Party. The 18th representative district is being changed, and Illinois has lost a representative seat. We'll tell you more about that as well. We will talk about Peoria's future guest speaker, Jasmine Zimmerstuki, from the International Solidarity Movement, ISM, who will be in town next month talking about her personal experiences in East Jerusalem. We got the state of BP, British Petroleum, 1 year after the Deepwater Horizon explosion. So don't turn that dial or stop this podcast. News and views of for Peoria, Illinois are just minutes away. This is WAZU Peoria. Private First Class Bradley Manning, after allegedly leaking 251,000 classified files of information to the website called WikiLeaks, which has also released only a small percentage of the files so far, has been court-martialed and placed in Quantico Marine Base in Virginia, where he has remained in custody for the past 10 months. Manning is being charged with 34 violations of leaking classified material that could be used as evidence for numerous U.S. war crimes committed in Iraq and Afghanistan. Among the charges is that of aiding the enemy, which carries a sentence of life in prison or possible execution. While waiting to be tried, Manning spends his time in 23-hour solitary confinement, staying in a cell that is approximately 6 feet wide and 12 feet in length. He is cut off from appropriate exercise and other rights afforded to prisoners at the brig. And for a month, he was being stripped naked every night while having a guard wake him every 5 minutes to supposedly prevent him from hurting himself, but it was in reality preventing Manning from resting and sleeping. This specific punishment was forced onto Manning, even though the brig's psychiatrist had said to take Manning off suicide watch, only to have it roll back to preventive of injury watch. As Manning wrote in a legal letter recently, he gave his own description of his confinement, saying, "The determination to strip me of all my clothing every night since the 2nd of March 2011 is without justification and therefore constitutes unlawful pretrial punishment." According to Colonel Dave LaPon, a Pentagon spokesman, denying these allegations, saying, "Except for a brief period about a month ago, and for reasons of Manning's own physical safety, Manning does not sleep naked, nor is Manning awakened every 5 minutes by brig personnel. These facts are simply not true." But Juan Mendez, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, went in to investigate if Manning's treatment fit the definition of torture, but was blocked from having an unmonitored visit with Manning, which means that brig authorities could monitor their conversations and possibly use whatever Manning said in those conversations against him in a court of law. A group of 300 constitutional scholars and authors have demanded an end to Manning's treatment, which they believe is illegal and immoral. Among those asking for this to end is Harvard professor Lawrence Tribe, who formerly taught constitutional law to President Barack Obama and had served as an advisor on the legal access issues at the Justice Department. Mr. Tribe has written a letter condemning Mr. Manning's treatment. Tribe went on to tell The Guardian that Manning's confinement treatment was not only shameful but unconstitutional, in the way it violates his personal and his liberty without due process of law, and in the way it administers cruel and unusual punishment of a sort that cannot be constitutionally inflicted even upon someone convicted of terrible offenses, not to mention someone merely accused of such offenses. Recently, Congressman Dennis Kucinich has tried unsuccessfully to visit Manning without being monitored.
Well, we've got to make sure that he is not being kept in conditions that would be considered to violate his basic constitutional rights. there is a prohibition in the Constitution against cruel and unusual punishment. I want to make sure that his rights have been protected. And so the only way to do that is to visit him and talk with him.
Marine rules clearly state that people conducting official government business, either on behalf of the prisoner or in the interest of justice, can be allowed official visits not subject to monitoring by the brig. That explicitly includes members of Congress like Representative Kucinich. The national uproar has grown with marches, petitions, letters, protests, and even P.J. Crawley, the former Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs at the U.S. State Department, who was forced to resign after making remarks concerning Manning's detention. He said that Manning was being mistreated in the military brig at Quantico, Virginia, and that what is being done to Bradley Manning is ridiculous and counterproductive and stupid on the part of the Department of Defense. He still defends what he said that day.
I think the treatment of Bradley Manning, while the prosecution is legitimate, the restrictive treatment undermines the credibility of that prosecution and has had effect both in terms of opinions in this country and around the world. I express what I says and I stand by my words.
President Obama said that he asked the Pentagon in telling reporters whether or not the procedures that have been taken in terms of his, Manning's, confinement are appropriate and are meeting our basic standards. They assure me that they are. But the Obama administration has taken a more aggressive step towards silencing and prosecuting whistleblowers, with comments from Hillary Clinton stating that the WikiLeaks material is an attack on America and they'll hold those accountable who leaked it. It's just one of the many things that reveal what the administration is about. The treatment of Bradley Manning is the Obama administration saying this is what happens when you air out our dirty laundry. Hopefully, the people of this country see this injustice for what it is and call out the administration for its abusive behavior, and that more whistleblowers like Manning will continue to release information showing the lies that our government creates to protect itself and the corporate sector.
For a better place, will you fight for a better place with me? Till the end of this story, when it all gets written again. And things will never be the same. And things will never be the same. Oh, you can feel that constant change. No, things will never be the same for me, my friends.
On April 15th of last week, in observance of Federal Tax Day historical deadline, which as we all know this year is not April 15th, but it's the April 18th, but in observance of taxation, local Peoria Tea Party constituents assembled at the Peoria Riverfront to mourn for lost revenues and to mourn for taxation. Many people spoke to the people in attendance, but I spoke to Lex Green, who proclaimed a freedom from taxation, while I argued that taxation is the only way we'll ever have civilization. This is what we had to say to each other. Please excuse the audio quality of this next segment. The wind was very bad, and there were people talking all around us. But I do think it'll give justice to the points that he and I both brought up.
People say the government, or rather the legislators, work for us. They have to recognize that we're not asking for them to give us things, but rather to do what government was originally set up for, and that was to protect our rights and to establish uniform rules of commerce and, you know, some infrastructure, and that's it. So if we were limited to that, then they would be serving our needs.
So how would we get the other things we have if we didn't have them?
Well, the same way we got them before we had the IRS, before the 16th Amendment. People would take care of each other. They would take care of themselves. They would work hard. They would get some money, and people in need would be cared for by their families, by their churches, and by their communities.
Before the 16th Amendment, which was the instatement of income tax, we didn't even have the interstate highway system. So how did we get the revenues to afford that?
Well, the revenues would come from my thinking is something like the fair tax would be a good way to do it, where instead of taxing your income, taking from you what you've earned, they get it from when you purchase or consume. That way, if you really don't like giving taxes, you consume less, and it's also proportionally takes more from the rich because they buy more things. So,
it would increase prices because the poor would buy less things, and only a minority of people are rich, and the price of goods would go up then to increase the need for revenues in the government to function.
Yes, the price of goods would go up, but people would have even more disposable income because of the lack of taxes, so income taxes.
But it wouldn't go as far because the goods are more expensive.
Again, I think the net amount of money going into your pocket is going to be more than what you're going to be spending. That's my prediction on that, and I encourage anybody to check out the Fair Tax. It's online. I've got it here somewhere, but they'll find out that these analyses have been done. It's actually going to be a net less amount of taxes out of everybody's pocket than what is being paid now.
Do you think government should educate?
No, as a matter of fact, I don't. I think that education should be taken care of by locally. I think ultimately the parents are the person most responsible for education of their children, and then from there to locally to the community. Or I think that a privately run schools would do a much better job than government run schools. And you do have to think about the fact that if the government is controlling what you learn, that can set up a dangerous precedent.
Wouldn't privately run schools cause a inequality between the people who can have the privilege of affording to go and the people who can't? Because the fact it wouldn't be a right, it would be a privilege to afford.
Well, education isn't a right. It's something we want. It's a very, it's something we want for all of our children, but it's not a right.
Right now it is. It's given to us.
It's given to us by government, and it's given to us very poorly because the government schools do not have a good rate of graduation, and I would say that they don't teach our children critical thinking and necessary science skills and so on and so forth. Private schools are generally desirable. If you just go around and check, most people would rather have their kids in private schools rather than in failing government schools.
Couldn't we just increase government revenues to make the schools better?
Sure. I mean, that's one option. We just keep taxing people until government shows that they are totally inept at the education game. I personally would prefer to see it the other way because I'm taxed enough already.
I made $8,000 last year, so when I did my taxes, I made $8,000. I knew that because I did the form and everything. And I saw that only $40 went to Medicare in that whole time, and I was fine with it. And I thought, I can't believe they didn't take any more because someone got to have a baby for free, potentially. Someone got to be well from once they were sick. And, just as Jesus healed the blind man, the blind man said, well, I don't know, but I was once blind, but now I see. And if government has the potential to do something good, I think we should never stop. What do you say about that?
Well, I think that the central assumption there is that government does things best, better than the private sector or better than average citizens can do. And I don't agree to that. I grew up in the 60s, and we distrusted the establishment for good reason, because they were not looking after the welfare of the people. They were looking after their own interests. And unfortunately, I think that's still the same today. So as much as I would like to see an Eden on Earth, I don't think the government's going to give it to us, because in order to give, the government has to take. And when they take, they have to take by force. And that is not what I consider an Eden.
Well, so do the privatists, who would eventually own everything if we never had the government to make sure everyone owed a little bit of something.
Well, I guess I do have to say I agree with John Locke in that you can go too far where you're owning prohibits anybody else from being able to own as well. But that is not the usual case. That is a rare case. And in fact, the right to own property is very, very important to our republic. and to the very rights that we based our nation on. So I think that private ownership of property, private enterprise, free markets are the way to go, and big government is hostile to that whole concept.
Privatists demanded that the government publicize their debt and make it be paid for by all of us through taxes. Why will the privatists never let the government be a tool that publicizes wealth or publicizes profit so we can all share in it in prosperity? I think that should be the function of government. Limiting government will only lead to privatists owning it and doing what they did when we bailed them out over and over again.
You know, that sounds very good. The problem we run into is government tends to be controlled by, not by free markets or free marketeers, but rather by people in power who use their government ties to grow their own wealth and deprive others of it. So this is what we call corporatism. I'm for free markets where government is not involved, because anytime you get government involved in that kind of a relationship, what you might call privatists really aren't for free markets. They are for putting more money in their pocket at your expense, and a relationship with government helps that rather than hurts that. It's been proven time and time again that as you go towards a socialist type society, there has to be a certain amount of force applied to other people to make it work, such as the IRS forcing people to pay their taxes. And good people don't like to play that game. So generally, the thugs and the people who are ruthless tend to be the people that rise to power. And when they're in bed with the very rich, we don't get free markets, we don't get justice, all we get is tyranny and more oppression.
But government officials can be elected, and corporate CEOs aren't. See, that's why the EPA exists, because corporations aren't going to do anything that stops their profit margin. A government body needs to come in and be a impartial voice against their desire to profit only.
Well, I wish it was that way. You're talking to somebody who's number one, an average citizen who ran for governor. I'm also a person that ran as a third party. I've seen up close and personal what the big money contributions has done to real choice. You do not have real choice. You have the choices presented to you by the Republicans and Democrats, paid for by the big corporations. So if you really like to see more choice and more fairness, you're going to have to see less influence of government, not more.
Well, what about the FEC, the Federal Election Commission? That could have an average man become elected if that thing was just funded, and you could have won.
Again, who's going to fund it? They're going to get funded. The money's coming primarily.
It's a box. It's a box you check on your tax form. Yes, I want to donate. Yes, I want to donate $3 for the Federal Election Commission. That could have gone to public money that you could have used to run a successful gubernatorial campaign. But you wouldn't have believed in it. Maybe you wouldn't have taken it.
Well, number one, I wouldn't have taken it because I'm a libertarian and I don't believe in taking any more government money than I have to. But again, that money is distributed by the government, by bureaucrats who control that money, and I guarantee you, you're going to run into a lot of problems in publicly funded elections with trying to qualify who deserves to get that money and how it gets distributed. I doubt the people who are in power are going to open it up in such a way that they lose power.
Yeah. Well, thanks for talking to me. What's your name?
Lex Green.
Lex Green. All right.
The time that I spent in the wind down at the riverfront with these crazy Tea Party nutbags who I hate so much was sort of depressing and uneventful. You know, I kind of brought my A game, I thought, and I was arguing for the right side, I was arguing for the left, I was arguing for, you know, increased revenues to create a better common world, to create a better common good, and they were fighting for decreased revenues to create nothing, forever. They want nothing. They just want nothing to be done. I was trying to point out the downfall in that. I was trying to point out private ownership would end up ruling everything and all goods and services would be rendered to the people by some corporate profit margin. And they didn't seem to argue against that, but they didn't seem to argue that it was bad, that outcome would be bad. They didn't agree with an impartial government that could do the will of the people. and make a more fair and just world. I think these people are pretty crazy. I think they're pretty wacko. I'm going to follow them around making fun of them for the rest of my life. It's going to be something I do forever and ever. I can't wait till they have another event. I'll get better audio the next time. And yeah, look forward to hearing more about the idiocy of the Tea Party. These people believe that education is a privilege, that health is a privilege. They don't think anything should be, any rights of health or education should be protected by the government, or even brought to us by the government. They want to see a private world between people who can afford to have things and those who cannot. Their mentality should not stand, and people who care should stand up against them. You know, this is a pretty fitting piece of audio I want you to hear. It's from last week's show. It's got the labor president of the Central Illinois Council on Labor. He's got some great things he says. It's really great.
It's real good to get out there and jump up and down. I'm against taxes. Well, then stay off our roads, stay off our bridges, stay out of our schools, stay out of our libraries. Get real. Grow up.
You got to love that. It was short and sweet, too.
Whoever wins in November, the rivers will flow into the Charles and the Rio Bravo. The nuke dumps will widen and the forests will burn until the time comes when we finally learn that whoever wins in November, neolib neocon, stands only for death. Whichever face he has on, we will build a new world and set us all free. Once we drive the whole lot of them right out of D.C. Whoever wins in November.
This Wednesday, April 20th, will be the 1-year anniversary of the BP PLC's Wakanda oil well spill from its drilling rig Deepwater Horizon. The spill led to 4.9 million barrels in total, which is 38 million gallons of oil, or around 2.5 million gallons per day, gushing out into the Gulf of Mexico for 87 days straight. The initial explosion on the rig killed 11 oil workers, bringing the Deepwater Horizon to the ocean floor, spewing out oil in the process. Even though the geyser of oil has been capped, the oil that has been released will continue to kill off the marine life for decades to come. And it's not just the oil that we have to worry about. BP has used at least 1.9 million gallons of toxic dispersants when trying to sink the oil, in an effort that BP claimed was aimed at keeping the oil from reaching shore. Critics believe the chemical dispersants were used simply to hide the oil and minimize BP's responsibility for environmental fines. Some of these immediate problems involved the chemical dispersants is the health damage it has on workers who are on the ground cleaning up the mess. Many reports came out in the aftermath of the spill, citing lax safety precautions and other hazards. Although the effects of the dispersants are monitored, questions linger about the long-term impacts of the chemical dispersants used to break up the oil and other containments. Tens of thousands of workers, who presumably were not professionally trained to handle extreme hazards, were dealing with toxins like benzene and volatile organic compounds and sulfur dioxide. And despite earlier warnings from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency about the dangers of Corexit, which they still allowed to be used, no one was sure what the long-term causes would be or what was inside Corexit. Long-term claims present a bigger problem. Victims of BP oil spill have 3 years to file long-term claims against the company. If they accept a settlement, however, they must waive their right to sue BP and accept that current predictions about the extent of the damage will hold, even as debates rage in the scientific community about just how bad things might be. Those who also suffer and die but go without a voice can only be seen in distant pictures. Pelicans fought to struggle out of oiled water that covered them like death. The disruption of the animal food chain, which goes unseen by many, will become more apparent as time goes on and when mass die-offs like dolphins, sea turtles, and sperm whales continue until extinction. Despite the destruction, the death and loss of habitat, legislation to protect the ones BP and the other oil companies destroy has not been passed. due to economic ramifications that supposedly trump life. Republicans and the oil state Democrats do not want to eliminate the liability cap that oil companies have to pay, aside from containing the spill and cleanup. Doing so would shut out small producers and devastate an already battered coastal economy, they say. Some measures, although very weak in the face of what has happened, have Democrats wanting to raise the liability cap to $250 million, or create an unlimited liability, such as the one that New Jersey Senator Robert Menendez wants to propose. Recently, Menendez had responded to reports saying, "I believe that we still need a legislation response to the liability issues that we learned from that spill. And I had hoped that when the spill manifested itself and the consequences to fishermen, to coastal communities, to business, to the economy, to the Gulf region, it would have spurred the Congress to action. Unfortunately, the oil industry is very powerful here, and they work very hard at preventing the type of effort that we want to move forward on, but we have not given up on it. And so we continue to press, which I believe should be unlimited liability, so when you mess up, you clean up." As well intended that Senator Menendez may be with the unlimited liability, this is measured in dollar signs for punishment, not prison sentences. Also, Senator Mary Landrieu, Democrat of Louisiana, one of the chief opponents of the unlimited liability language, in February told E&E Reporter that, "We want to do it that in a way that keeps the industry as robust as possible between the large multinational companies and the smaller independent companies." In the past, Landrieu has not kept her relations with oil companies as a secret.
"And I've received money from oil companies, I've received money from environmental groups. I'm very proud to actually receive money from both sides of this debate because they, I believe, understand that I'm as honest a broker as I can be here. I mean, I am not a handmaiden to the oil industry, but I will tell you this, this country uses 20 million barrels of oil a day. We produce here in the United States less than half. Yeah. So our choice is either to increase, you know, our reliance on friends, you know, and I say that in quotes, like Venezuela, Cuba, and other places to get our oil, or we learn how to drill it safely here." Mm. And again, you've got to put this accident in perspective. The last thing we need to do is shut this oil and gas industry down.
Another person in many who fails to grasp the problem at hand is Eric Walschlegel, a spokesman for the American Petroleum Institute. The industry's main trade group said the legislation that imposes new fees would not achieve the results that some of these members are trying to achieve. It would actually reduce investment, reduce revenues, and harm jobs. Some may remember when the Obama administration backed the American Petroleum Institute when they intervened a court order to reverse it. That court order was by the Washington, D.C. Appeals Court, which ruled in April 2009 that the Bush administration's five-year plan for offshore oil and gas drilling. The courts viewed the plan as not being based on a proper review of the environmental impact of the drilling. Only days before the drilling, though, the Obama administration had granted BP a categorical exclusion, exempting it from an environmental impact study for the Deepwater Horizon project. Also, documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act show BP officials openly discussing how to influence the work of scientists supported by the fund, which was created by the oil company in May last year. In February, the Obama administration, through the National Marine Fisheries Service, issued a gag order to force marine scientists who were contracted to document the spikes in dolphin mortality and to collect specimens and tissue samples to keep their findings confidential. But this shouldn't be too big of a surprise, since the Obama administration can say straight-faced that the vast majority of oil in the Gulf was gone. These individuals talk as if the economy is what keeps us alive, not the land base or oceans or the ecosystem that is collapsing around us. The economy is of concern, not the giant dead zone out in the Gulf where nothing can survive. All solutions to supposedly avert from these destructive practices to sustain a very unsustainable way of living are co-opted with the industrial system, which continues to destroy the very things, water, air, livable land, that keep human and non-human species alive. This system that we live in wants us to think we can do without nature, that nature will survive no matter what we throw at it, and that progress and improvements in technology are more important. But what the politicians, businessmen, workers, and everyone else fail to grasp is that we cannot have it all. It's either the oil that gives us a cheap, easy way of living, but brings destructive effects to the environment, or we can do away with oil for a more livable environment and healthy ecosystem. But we simply cannot have both.
Can't stand the news. It's always the same old song, another corporate scam. Another story of bad gone wrong, another corporate bailout, another piece of the pie. It's the best democracy money can buy. They rig the elections, and only millionaires can play, and you gotta be cynical. You gotta look into the camera and say, I'm serving the public. When you know it's a corporate lie, but it's the best democracy money can buy.
The Drinking Liberally Peoria chapter will be meeting this Tuesday, April 19th at 6:30 p.m. at Kelleher's Irish Pub in downtown Peoria. As always, join other liberals and progressives in a casual atmosphere for some conversation and camaraderie. Just come as you are, order some food and drink, and talk about what's on your mind. Also, tomorrow, April 19th, is the annual Global Village meeting at the Lakeview Library at 7 p.m. The annual Global Village will be hosting speaker Charlene Watts, talking about the past, present, and future of fair trade. Ms. Watts has been a fair trade pioneer for over 40 years, founded fair trade stores in Cleveland, Ohio, and Bloomington, Illinois, and wrote a how-to book about starting cooperative fair trade stores. She is currently co-manager of Crossroads Global Handcrafts in Bloomington. At the speaking, there will be fair trade refreshments. The event is free and open to the public. So for more information, call Global Village at 681-8180. And then on April 23rd, the documentary screening of Dive, which is about dumpster diving, will be followed up by a discussion with two divers at McLean County History Museum, which is on 200 North Main Street, Bloomington, Illinois, at 1:30 p.m. Also, on April 28th, Ralph Martia will speak to the League of Women Voters at 6:30 p.m. at the Lakeview Museum. Martia is a liberal economist who believes that taxes are good and necessary and lead to prosperity all around. The event is free and open to the public. Also on April 30th, Earth Day celebration at the Forest Park Nature Center will start at 11 a.m. till 4 p.m. It is free to the public, and it is family-oriented. Peoria Area Voices for Animals will be a participant, as well as the Peoria Peace Network. There will also be earth-friendly vendors, educational booths, music, food, and activities for children. And on May 12th, the Peoria chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union will hold its annual meeting at the Banquet and the Ivy Club to celebrate its 50th anniversary in Peoria. Speaker is Colleen Connell, Executive Director of the ACLU of Illinois. She is the first female attorney to lead the Illinois organization and has been active in directing litigation efforts on reproductive rights and abortion rights and protection in state facilities for the mentally ill, prisoners, and the disabled. The talk is free, or reservations can be made to attend the banquet. For more information, see the chapter's website at www.aclupeoria.org. Hello, Peoria. I'd like to thank everyone for listening to our show today. I just wanted to add that right now the Solidarity Journal is completely operated by Zach and myself, and we are definitely looking for any other volunteers who would want to help out in any way they can with the radio show. If you'd want to if you have any interest in doing this, please get in contact with Zach or me. My email is peril36@yahoo.com. And Zach?
And mine is zachteague@live.com, ZACKTEAGUE @live.com. We need all the help we can get. To conclude today's show, I'm going to leave you with a special treat. straight from the Pacifica Radio Archives, which you can access at www.pacificaradioarchives.org. We bring you Seabrook, A History of Nuclear Opposition, produced by Phyllis Jaffe in 1979. This is the story of the occupation of lands by citizens who didn't want to have a nuclear power plant built on them.
And this is a momentum. I mean, we are building something which is going to stop this plant. And we started out with 18 people walking down the tracks, and now we are 10 times that number. So we're now 180 strong, and we're going to be building from there. These people are going to all here be arrested, and it's going to make a bigger statement than when 18 people were arrested. We're committed to stopping this plant, and by occupying it, that's the way we're going to do it. I mean, the legislator won't listen to us, the governor won't listen to us, the courts are an insufficient way of getting the message out, so we must take it right to the people, and that is by committing civil disobedience, violating a court order if necessary, and showing them that this is a committed bunch of people, that we're making a statement for all of mankind and not just for those people who call us leaf lovers and kooks.
We're here today to occupy the ground at the end of Rocks Road, to defend it from further desecration, and to prevent the erection by the Public Service Company of New Hampshire of a nuclear power plant. This site, part of our precious 18 miles of seacoast, is threatened by power and wealth from beyond our borders, and unresponsive to we who live here. With arrogance, the Public Service Company has ignored the vote of the people of Seabrook and local communities against any nuclear generating facility. As individuals and representatives of the Clamshell Alliance, we are here to express our opposition. With our bodies acting in nonviolence, we symbolize the cry of all life to prevent further violence to this land. The utility and government have acted in collusion. They are attempting to force this atomic monster upon us. We believe their actions are irresponsible and immoral. We are compelled by our consciences to take this act of civil disobedience. In opposition to the death posed by the construction of a nuclear power plant, we take our stand in an affirmation of life. For the rich heritage we inherit, for the present lives we lead, and for the future generations to come, we bear a message. With simplicity and conviction, we say, the Seabrook nuke will not be built.
In 1968, the Public Service Company of New Hampshire, which supplies the state with 90% of its electricity, quietly announced its intention to build twin 1,150-megawatt atomic reactors in Seabrook, a small town on New Hampshire's seacoast, 2 miles from the ocean, less than 5 miles from the Massachusetts border, and 40 miles north of Boston. The site chosen is a 715-acre rock outcropping in a delicate marshy estuary, which is a breeding ground for thousands of seabirds and marine life. The plant itself would require 40 acres of land, including an ancient Indian burial ground. According to the Audubon Society, there probably isn't a worse place in the United States for building a nuclear plant than the Seabrook site. In addition to the ecological dangers, the nearby popular beaches of Salisbury and Hampton pose evacuation nightmares, and the site is close to a relatively active earthquake fault. So it was not surprising that despite promises of tax benefits, jobs, and business, the citizens of Seabrook voted against the plant in March 1976 by a margin of 768 to 632. The town selectmen, however, called the vote non-binding and allowed construction plans to continue. Opposition to the plant grew as townspeople talked with each other about it. Then, in April 1976, a group of anti-nuclear activists marched 85 miles across New Hampshire to collect signatures for a nuclear moratorium. When in June of 1976 the Public Service Company was granted a conditional building permit pending Environmental Protection Agency approval of the cooling system, those opposed to the plant formed the Clamshell Alliance and announced a nonviolent plant-side occupation modeled after similar successful European actions. This would not be the first act of civil disobedience against an American nuclear plant, however. Earlier, New Hampshire seacoast resident Ron Reich had occupied a tower on the Seabrook construction site for 30 hours in sub-zero weather. And still earlier, Massachusetts resident Sam Lovejoy had toppled a weather tower constructed for the proposed nuclear plant in Montague, his hometown. On August 1, 1978, 18 seacoast residents were arrested for attempting to occupy the site of the Seabrook nuke.
The shot heard round the world for the anti-nuclear movement.
All right.
It's the first time that the opponents of nuclear power have made a clear statement there that they are moving from the stage of debate into the stage of direct action. The people who are going in to occupy the site today are risking arrest, are putting their bodies on the line to stop nuclear power plants.
It's a real good day for New Hampshire people and New England people. Hundreds of New England organizations, hundreds of New Hampshire organizations of informed, reasonable people have spoken out loudly and clearly at every level of the process onto deaf ears. Today we have a chance to speak to the world, and I think the world will be listening.
We do claim this land. This land belongs to the people of the United States, to the people of New Hampshire. It is not a fit site for a machine that creates radioactivity that could kill us all.
Our folks are coming together. Control of our lives we demand. We think we can handle it better than experts from Washington land. Power, power, community power is ours for free. Power, power, oh bring back my power to me. Well, our friend Sam, he toppled that tower. Our friend Ron, he froze in the sky. The Seabrook 18 got arrested, and our turn will come by and by. Power, power.
My name is Paul Gunter, and we're here now at right on the coast to assemble in a rally to initiate a model occupation of the Seabrook nuclear power plant site in attempts to turn construction away and initiate a non-violent people's occupation of the site.
I can't ask anyone else to do this unless I've done it, unless I'm willing to do it myself. And if things proceed the way they have in Europe, it's going to take a lot of people to stop this thing, not just 15 like they're out here today, but you know, masses, thousands of people. And they need to be there in body, not just in a signature on a petition or anything like that.
This is private property.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Bruce Beckley, Public Service Company. You're entering private property. I've offered you a spot to plant your trees. Beyond this point, you're trespassing.
Yeah.
You are on private property. We've offered you a spot where we're already saving the trees. You can add to that area if that's your true intent. But we're not going to let you go on the site and stay here tonight. You'll be subject to criminal trespass charges.
Our intent is to stop construction of the nuclear power plant.
Steve's got a good tree to plant.
Where's the show? Where's Tom?
You have to make a big hole.
How about opening it up? Like everybody just move back and open it up. Just a little
fan out. There
they are.
This is our tree planting ceremony. Welcome to our tree planting ceremony.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's our turn.
3 weeks later, on August 22, 1976, 180 people were arrested in the second Seabrook plant site occupation attempt.
Can you take a minute before you drive us off? And,
we'll be right back.
We're from Boston, for starters, in Cambridge. That's close enough that we'd be in danger if there was an accident at the plant here.
Just like you.
We don't want you left alone.
Do you know that the waste from the plant, you know, are around for a quarter of a million years and they're poison, deadly poison? What about Seabrook voting against it?
Back, and that's a fact.
In October 1976, 2,000 people attended an alternative energy fair in nearby Hampton Beach in preparation for yet another occupation the following spring. On April 30, 1977, over 2,000 people successfully occupied the site of the Seabrook nuke. The next day, 1,414 were arrested and held in National Guard armories for 2 weeks.
In America, you certainly have a right to an opinion that is opposite that of other people. And you do have an opinion that is opposite of what I have with respect to nuclear power. So you came, as I understand it, to let the world know that there is another side and that you represent that other side. Okay. Now, on the other hand, you understand that you are here against the laws of the state of New Hampshire. You are trespassing here.
We are the river, we're gonna wash your levees down. We're coming from the mountains, and we're moving through your town. We're gonna join with the other rivers, and then we'll have a chance. And no dam the man can make will stand when the sea begins to dance. Maple buds are red now, and the small streams trickling down. Brooks are running swollen, now the river's on the rise in town. And there'll be no more of your reservoirs holding us from being free. Flood time's here as we're moving to the sea.
Another occupation was scheduled for the summer of 1978, but was changed in a controversial decision at the last minute to a legal rally. Diane Garand, a Seabrook resident, talked about this with reporter Paul McIsaac.
It's three-quarters of it's political. You know, this fear of reprisal, I guess, you know, one way or another, whether it be in your family or your friends or whatever. And the town was, you know, basically open as far as the town offices were concerned, as of a little over a week ago. And then this strange, I don't know, sort of an intangible pressure started coming down, you know, and people thought, well, gee, if they put the injunction through, that makes anybody in contempt of court, and they can come onto your property and arrest you and everyone who's there. And I don't think a lot of people were willing to lose everything they'd worked all their lives for.
The injunction Diane refers to was sought by the Public Service Corporation, and it seemed to make anyone aiding and abetting clamshell members likely to arrest. Once in court, this implied restriction was dropped, however. But the point is, the fear was still there. Did Diane believe that the Public Service Corporation would use such a tactic?
They'd do anything to get the way they want, you know. It's scary. It really bothers me. But I think that was the basic feeling, because I got several calls. There was a meeting here last weekend with the clam, and there were quite a few here. And Saturday morning, I got a call from one of the selectmen and several landowners. And their feeling was, if things went on the way they were with the original proposal, that they'd have to withdraw support.
And did they say why specifically at that time? Could they put their finger on it?
It was intangible, and it wasn't just Seabrook. It was in all the towns around, and it even flowed over into Salisbury. And there were no names given and no specific agencies given. It was just one of those things that something hard and heavy was coming down, and everyone knew it, but they didn't know exactly where it was coming from. You know, and everybody had that same ominous feeling, and it was just, it was kind of strange, you know. It gave you second thoughts. You were like you had a split personality. On one hand, you wanted to do it and not care about it, and then you thought, well, you know, it's different putting your body out and saying, all right, arrest me, take me away. And when you get out, or you pay your fine or whatever, and you come back, everything is basically the same. But if you lose everything you've got, I mean, enough strings can be pulled so they could take away everything you had. You know, and I think this is what people feared, you know. They didn't really know what was coming down.
Diane Garand and other local anti-nuke organizers were finally able to convince the coordinating committee of the Clamshell Alliance that they should accept the state's offer for a legal demonstration. This caused tremendous strain within the clamshell, but for Diane, the local effect was nothing but positive.
You could almost hear the sigh of relief all over town.
the danger of catastrophe, of a loss of coolant accident, the dangers of constant low-level radiation emitted, and the dangers that are involved in the fiasco around waste disposal affect all of us. But as just as important is the realization that the labor movement is coming to, that there is no way that traditional trade union issues, such as the cost of living and the question of jobs, can be separated from an energy policy for this country.
We, lesbians and feminists, share a common daily struggle with the third world, minorities, and the poor. Alternative energy sources controlled by the people are what we need.
The original inhabitants of this part of the country never ate clams. And so the problem was that clams was allowed to grow unmolested in the coastal waters of America for millions of years. And I'm not talking about clams in general, but I'm talking about each clam. So you could imagine what a 2-million-year-old clam could look like. Could look like a big clam. When they get big like that, God gives them little feet so that they could get around easy. Imagine being on one of them boats coming over to discover America and not knowing about them giant clams. Sitting there late at night all by yourself, you hear the pitter-patter of little feet on deck. Is that you, kids? It ain't. My God, it's a humongous giant clam.
When I was an associate director of the Lawrence Livermore Weapons Laboratory, in charge of biology and medicine, I once engaged Dr. Roger Batesel, who's now director of that laboratory, in a discussion of the folly of nuclear weapons and the solution of human problems. His reply was that the job of the weapons laboratory scientists was to make the best nuclear weapons and to leave to politicians and statesmen the questions of the use of those weapons. So, the power privilege elite and its technologists have concluded there's simply no problem with nuclear power, and they're going ahead to produce the radioactive garbage come hell or high water. And since their wisdom comes from on high, the proper role of the peons is to accept that wisdom, an objective, scientifically reasoned wisdom, especially since it is based upon that marvelous, reliable material known as thin air.
Is that just something wrong with the Seabrook plant, with nuclear power plants? Or is there something wrong with the utility that wants to build it? Or, in fact, is there something wrong with an energy industry that has to be running utilities like this? That's the answer. The answer is it's not only that Seabrook symbolizes what's wrong with nuclear power, it also symbolizes what's wrong with private utilities and what's wrong with the whole energy industry.
He's a Northwestern legend and a wobbly Utah Phillips.
Just a little short one here so we can keep things moving. This is a song I made up for myself, if I can remember it. It's about that loveliest of all words, so vastly abused, anarchy. This is about all of the different things that I try to make myself resist, you know, as I try to get through the world like everybody else. Oh, I have led a good life full of peace and quiet. Now I shall have an old age full of rum and riot. Yes, I have been a good lad, careful and artistic. Now I shall have an old age, coarse and anarchistic. Once I paid my taxes and followed every rule, banker, boss, and bureaucrat thought me a willing tool. I voted Democratic and paid the church its due. Now all those swine will have to find some other chump to screw. Interest, banks, and credit, insurance, tax, and rent. Of lawyers, agents, generals, and clerics I repent. With this for corporations and scorn for those elected, oh, I will be an old bum, loved but unrespected.
Good afternoon. My name is Kariak Taje. I'm from Ganyange. I thank you for inviting me to speak before you and to come and help your struggle. I see that the white man has extended his oppressions to his own people. And I guess. Yeah. I guess you know how the Indians have felt now for the last 150 years or 200 years.
And I just came here to say thanks to you all for doing what you're doing. You know, a lot of people say, well, where's the blacks? How come the NAACP come out for nuclear energy? Well, I can't speak for them. I love them. And all I can say is I'll fight for the right for a nigger to be wrong just like I will white folks to be wrong. But I think a question that should be asked is, where are the black folks? Where are the poor folks? Where's the Indians, Chicanos, and Puerto Ricans? I think if that question would be asked back in your neighborhood before you got here, they're not there neither. I mean, it's not like we have always been there. It seems like when we always sharing in the luxuries and the finer things of life, nobody questioned where welfare mothers are. It's only when we get in adverse situations where they might bring in tanks, where there might be arrest, where there might be, and everybody questions where everybody. I'll tell you one thing. You probably wouldn't be here neither if you had lost more loved ones by rat bites and lead poisoning and starvation than by atomic energy. That's the same black folks that when I was growing up was thrilled to death when a black got drafted into the war because it didn't represent killing. It didn't represent an extension of this vicious nation's hand. It represented G.I. Bill. It represented money. It represented three meals. It represented doctors. It represented you could get married because you got an allotment check coming back. It represented I could go to med school and become a doctor. And I never understood that that type of degree would have blood on it for the rest of my life. The NAACP, I know what happened. They was blackmailed. If you want jobs for the masses of the people that's unemployed, then we have to have energy. And we have to see to it that that type of nuclear blackmail will never happen again.
Finally, in October 1979, over 2,000 people organized by the Boston-based Coalition for Direct Action again attempted a nuke site occupation at Seabrook. This time, they attempted to cut the fences surrounding the plant and were met by tear gas, mace, water hoses, dogs, and billy clubs.
If people move towards the fence and attempts are made to cut the fence, the police do have a liquid chemical on the order of mace, which has been used and will continue to be used.
Anything else?
At this time, no. It has been used this morning, yes.
Are dogs being used to keep the demonstrators back from the fences?
The dogs are present, and they are there for whatever purposes the state police deem necessary. Right now, since there has been no mass movement towards the fence, they've been mostly used for companionship.
What about fire hoses?
The capability exists to use water as a deterrent if necessary. We will make that judgment as we get closer to the situation.
Do you think this
tear gas is available to us, and we will make that judgment as it becomes necessary.
Here comes the police are now moving on people here now. When they got to my group, they hit me in the head. I tried to get up. When I realized that we were falling back, they pushed me down, they hit me again. They pulled my hair, they maced my face. I tried to get up, and they kicked me down again. This was such a blatant contrast between their action and our action. We didn't have bolt cutters, and we weren't at all provocative. We were sitting.
We're trying to get people into, it's obvious we can't occupy. We're trying for siege tactics now. As long as we're cutting their fences all the time, I don't imagine they can continue construction. I consider a violent act something that hurts human, any kind of life, anything living. This is property. It is not alive, and it's protecting something that's going to kill millions, you know. It could kill millions. It could destroy the earth, and it's just a fence, you know. It's something for us to get inside of.
This program was produced by Phyllis Jaffe with help from the New England Radio Alliance, Robert Lepser, Video Newsreel, the Vermont Association of Media Producers, and radio station WGDR-FM.
And you've been listening to WAZU, Peoria's one and only Pacifica Radio affiliate. This is the Solidarity Journal. We thank you for tuning in. Catch us next week for more news and views. Have a great day.
Till the end of this story, oh, when it all gets written again. Oh, when it all gets written again. And things will never be the same. And things will never be the same. And things will never be the same. Oh, you can feel that constant change.